Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our second day here of O'Reilly's Web 2.0 Expo in Berlin. In the first talk today, we will discuss the business of data, how it has dramatically changed in the last 5 to 10 years. The next 50 minutes are organized as follows. I will start giving an overview of about maybe 30 minutes, where I first start talking about the value of data being proportional to the impact of decision making. And I start with the traditional data business and basically come up with a thesis that maybe, with the exception of religion, all decisions should be depending on data. We then talk about the production of data. We then move to the value add, the aggregation of data. We then move in our logic to the consumption or the purchase of data. And I'm going to close with the limitations of data and the future of the data business. Then Jonathan will talk for about 10 minutes in a very beautiful presentation what his view as a former D.E. Shaw person, which is a quant shop in New York, and now a technologist at Imagination, what data is about. And then we should have 5 to 10 minutes where we open the mics for discussion. Okay. Okay. I don't have slides, but this outline here is what I will stick to, and I'm very happy to put that up on the web afterwards if you want to refer to it. And if you have any questions, if you would like to interrupt me in between, I'm very happy to take those questions. Okay, let's get started. Every decision other than religion depends on data. That's one of the mantras David Flaschen, the former CEO of Thomson Financial, actually has. And I have to say, he's known as the man who knows to turn data into money. And that's probably an interesting statement. Now, yesterday, I talked about that people often actually don't know their preferences well. That means people can be influenced. And the example I gave you that if you ask people to give their 3 reasons why they love their partner, they love their partner more afterwards. Whereas if you ask them to give the 10 most important reasons, they have a hard time coming up with them. And actually, they love their partner less. So the point of this for this talk is that people actually might not really know where they do need data in order to improve their decision making. With that in mind, let's look at the traditional data business. OAG, I'm not sure whether it's known in Europe. In the United States, it's the official airline guide. It helps us answer questions like, what flights suits me best? It's an independent publication, and that publication helps us to make decisions, for instance, which flights to buy. It's a business which was built on heavy business development and on very difficult ways of entering that business, because they had to have agreements with all the various businesses that provide airline data. Another example is Navtec. Tim O'Reilly, his wonderful keynote on the first day, mentioned that it got bought by $8.6 billion by Nokia. It took them $300 million to come to break even. That's a significant barrier to entry in this business here. Another example is Skytrax. Skytrax is a company that, for instance, operates the site called flatseats.com. Skytrax managed, again, to provide data to airlines, sticking to this example, to sort of enter the Web 2.0 world by having people give data about the experiences on flights. So that's a slight way of them protecting their business model by saying, okay, yes, we use the proprietary data, but let's also get a platform on which passengers can share their opinions. And I invite you to check out flatseats.com, and you'll be surprised if you every now and then fly, which most of you do, just how accurate and how detailed the descriptions are there. Why am I telling that story? No airline is interested in letting you know what the sucky seats are, the ones, you know, which don't recline, etc. like that. But passengers are very happy to give you those honest opinions. It's one example how basically all of us who experience this highly emotional product of flights contribute to creating transparency. Question down the road would be, how will that actually influence pricing? Is that sucky seat which doesn't recline the same $700 to fly from Berlin to Frankfurt as the slightly more comfortable seat which does recline? A few more examples. Maps. Why is there money in maps? Well, because the question again, what route do I take? How do I get from A to B? That certainly is helped by maps. Where would I go here? There's a company in California called Dash.net, D-A-S-H.net. Dash.net is similar to what you have here, TomTom, Garmin, but with one important difference. That difference is that actually the little device in your car communicates, as opposed to, you know, putting a chip in and it being, well, basically in Stone Age, pre-communication age. It communicates GPRS, if there's GPRS, but also Wi-Fi, WLAN, if there is Wi-Fi 802.11 connection. For instance, I have a Wi-Fi router in my garage. And when I'm at my computer, I right-click in the Firefox extension on an address, and directly my box in the car knows where I need to go. But it gets much better than that. It also up-communicates. That means those complicated models, 91, 93, I was at Xerox PARC, and we worked on chaotic models for modeling traffic on 101, which is the main route in California between San Francisco and Palo Alto. No need for those models anymore. Who needs models if you can measure traffic in real time? Because those devices, they talk. You know how the cars flow. And you just measure. Maybe you can even correct for it, saying, Andreas tends to, you know, drive 7% above average, so you correct for that, and you have the arrival time, unless something happens right in front of you within minutes. No longer that excuse, sorry, the traffic was bad today. Interesting how that influences people's decision making. Third example, company in Little Rock, Arkansas, called Axiom. Worldwide known, I know the China offices, I know that they work with a company in Europe as well. It's a B2B company. 24 out of the 25 top financial institutions in the United States use Axiom to answer questions like, who do I mail stuff to? And is that address really the same address as the other guy? Or should these two be different people? And that's, again, a business of data. It's very, very cheap. You pay 30 cents per person for hundreds of fields. How is that possible? 30 cents per person for hundreds of fields? Well, that's possible because you pay them month after month. And not only you, but most US businesses that do mail stuff pay that. So it's quite an interesting business. After the session, there's a session on behavioral targeting in a different room. And Frank Wagner, the CEO of a company called Nugget, N-U-G-G.A-D, which is based here in Berlin, he will actually comment on their business. One more example here, whitepages.com. Their starting point was to scan phone books, but only 90 million people of the about 300 million people in the United States, or 225 million above 18, are in the white pages, in the traditional telephone company's white pages. That's about a third. What about the remaining two-thirds of the people? How do you get them in? Well, again, it is trying to come up with new data sources. For instance, data sources like having people add their own data, having people add their own names, or inferring relationships, or scraping the web. So these traditional businesses of companies having authority over phone numbers quickly disappears. Two remarks of the change which we see. One, I pay month for month money for not getting listed. That's an indication of the future, that you pay for getting shielded as opposed to that you're getting others to access your data. And two, that nicknames, misspellings, if they are there, I'm very Wittgensteinian. If people misspell my name Weigand, for instance, and still want to find my number, why not just like Google? Well, do you mean this spelling? Help them out and get them the number. Okay, these were some examples of traditional businesses which have already the pointer towards how the world is changing. I now move to my second point. So far, I've talked about raw data, flight data, map data, telephone book data. Now, how do we actually get towards the decision support point that people are paying us more money? The first version here is to aggregate the data. What are new businesses in the data aggregation? One brilliant example which will change the way the real estate business is running is in America a company called Zillow, Zillow. And what Zillow does is it takes public records, aggregates them, and it allows end users to say, hey, how much would you sell your house for? And so people provide liquidity into a market which traditionally is very illiquid. There was no way of expressing interest, short of going to an agent, signing something, and knowing that 3% of the purchase price goes to that agent and 3% of the buyer goes to that agent too. What a funny business that you pay somebody, if you buy or sell a house of $1 million, $60,000, which you know you can hire a programmer for a year. Just in this information asymmetry gain that he says, oh yes, young man, I have a really good house for you. Westlaw or Thomson, part of Thomson, is another example of data aggregation. For the last 100-something years in the United States, they went through court proceedings after court proceedings and extracted them up, indexed them. These are public data. Court recorders are in the business of recording public proceedings. The Value Thomson or Westlaw, a huge building, thousands of people working there, provides is making it for that lawyer who is there possible to access the body of law of the United States for a handsome sum. On that note, Oliver Zume, who is one of the top internet lawyers here in Germany, will be giving a talk after Frank Wagner's talk at 11:20, iTube, YouTube, WeTube, about the implications of what these things of data collection have towards law. I like to contrast raw data versus information. Information for me is not what those of you who studied, say, electrical engineering know as information theory. It's not really about bits. But information for me has three slots. It is the data, United flight, 7 days delayed. It is the person, Andreas Weigand, and it is my situation. I don't care for most United flights being 7 days delayed. But for the one I'm supposed to be on, I do care dramatically. So whereas information theory, where we talk about entropy and bits and stuff like that, tends to ignore the recipient, his mindset, his interest, and ignore the situation, the way I talk about information here is that it helps me make decisions, namely maybe checking in with a different airline. Okay, data, the third point, are not just part of data companies, but data are central to basically all businesses. Yesterday, a company IPO'd, which I had the fortune doing some consulting with in the earlier days. The company was the largest IPO in Chinese history. Alibaba, The IPO in Hong Kong Stock Exchange, and the price raised 200% on the first day. Alibaba is an information company. Relatively simple. They have several million companies online, and those companies all provide their own information. And all they do is they make a phone call, maybe they send a letter, maybe they send a fax, and if they get a response for a couple of $1,000s, of course, you can be listed with a trust pass. Trust pass, meaning you can trust those guys. It is not about those companies primarily, but it's about those companies who want to buy, say, scooters. Alibaba, when I checked yesterday, had 8,000 companies in the People's Republic of China that sell scooters. That's an amazing aggregation compared to before, where Guangji, which would be relationships, determine where you buy stuff from. It's a marketplace where I think dimensions are which many of us can't really imagine. One small remark, which Jonathan will pick up afterwards, is you see here already how we move from the problem of data scarcity, of a desert of data, to data abundance, to a sea of data. Because before the problem was, well, how do I find a supplier if I want to buy 10,000 scooters? To now the problem, gee, which of those 8,000 suppliers should I trust? And the tools, the algorithms, the user-generated content, the help of the community, you need to get to deal with a second problem, a very different nature from the needs of the tools of the community, which you have to deal with the first problem, where you're happy if you find some guy somewhere who, you know, he knows somebody has bought a scooter in China. So that's the point I wanted to make, that most companies actually crucially depend on data, even if they don't consider themselves a data business, like, say, Otto Versand in Hamburg, when they buy scooters. There's one more element to this. And it's not just data, it's also being able to experiment. What sets companies such as Amazon.com, Google, eBay, etc., what makes them really good companies? What makes them good companies is their willingness and their ability to have an infrastructure to experiment. The classic example for experimentation is a company called Capital One. Bill Kahn, who has a team of about 50 people working for him, is in charge of experimental design, of sending out, no, I actually didn't ask him, but I would expect probably millions of letters every day. Very, very carefully crafted. All the stuff you might know about Latin hypercubes, all in this design. In order to just find out which person should get what offer, and the result is that the response rates are way significant higher than that of the second best company, which does experimental design, not as well in the credit card business. So it does pay off if your business is to actually get as many people to sign up with you as possible. An example in the UK, Jonathan will actually refer to later, is the company Tesco, which I think spends for several years a quarter of its profits to really build up data about its customers. And the company I worked with in the United Kingdom is called Nectar UK, which has major suppliers, British Airways I think is one of them, who work together in order to provide them with data about customers in order to build rich models. And again, experimental business is so important for them. Who do you send what offers? What response rates can we measure? Maybe I should give you one example here. Amazon.com has a co-branded credit card. The business is the following. If you sign up for a co-branded credit card, Amazon gets $100 and you get $30 in addition to that. Okay? So every year, it's about a $60 million cash for Amazon.com. What can you vary? You can vary an incredible number of things. You can vary where do you offer this card to people. You can vary what's the wording you put on those cards. And slight changes, for instance, a change between saying, well, if you fill out this card, you get $30 at your next purchase, versus you have $40.30 in your card, in your shopping cart. If you fill out the card now, you get that for $10.30. It's 400%, 400% higher conversion rate. So one of the subtexts when we talk about data and decisions, which I really, really want to get close to your hearts here, is people are people. We evolved over the thousands of years to deal with information, to deal with data. Most of our dealings with data are based on heuristics, are based on mental shortcuts, because our processes are pretty finite. And we just make decisions based on the information we have without being those rational agents economists deal with. It's not how people ought to make decisions, how people actually do make decisions. That field is called the field of behavioral economics. There's a wonderful book out by a guy called Dan Ariely. It's called Predictably Irrational, which is a nice, nice summary of those many small examples and big examples of how actually people systematically make suboptimal decisions, but systematically so. The internet in the data collection business and in experimentation business has allowed us to actually understand and, if you want, exploit, not in a negative sense, but to use the knowledge which we have about behavioral economics. And one little example is here. You all know Amazon's people bought X, also bought Y, which is a very simple way of exploiting data. Namely, you exploit the co-purchasing data. And it turns out, even if you show people random stuff, if in doubt, people edge a little bit to the more expensive side. Because you never know, if something is too cheap, you know, it might break or something like that. So there are these biases built into people that, well, you don't know what's really happening if you spend too little money. So sometimes those things, irrespective of the smartness of the actual algorithms, will actually help you sell stuff which might have a higher profit margin. Let's take, yes. Okay, I have more notes in here than I have time for because I need to make the 10 minutes for Jonathan. The very quick point here is that in finance, there are agency problems. So I might know something about a certain stock. I might know something about a certain company having been acquired by another company yesterday. But even if I was allowed to tell you that, which I'm not yet, even if I was allowed to tell you this, it might not be in my interest until I have completed my acquisition of the stock of that company. There's an interesting company Mike Shah has in San Francisco called Wikivest, W-I-K-I-N-V-E-S-T. And I invite you to look at this, which is an interesting blend between user-generated content and finance. Let's take a step back in history and consider how data has been produced. In the 70s and 80s, basic production of computer data was here in the back office. Say roughly 10 million people were participating in that business. The 80s to 90s, when I was an undergraduate, it was back office and front office, which is roughly 100 million people, an order of magnitude more. I'm a physicist by training, so I'm just doing things in order of magnitude. Now, that meant people could poke at stuff, querying a database. That was what we had from the 80s to 90s. But people could not really produce anything. 90s to 2000, keeping in mind that the web started in 2004. 90s to 2000, we had not 100 million people, but roughly 1 billion people poking at stuff. It's called searching. Very easy interface. It used to be COBOL up here, then it was Alta Vista, just a simple box as a command line. What's new in this decade? What's dramatically new is not that we have more than a billion people poking at stuff because we roughly have a billion people on the internet. no difference there. But it is that we have roughly 100 million people producing stuff. So if you take the number of people poking times the number of people producing, then you see this dramatic change here, which has happened in the last few years. If you take the product, you now suddenly have something which is way, way larger than what we ever had before. Dig is a beautiful example of those non-linearities that are happening in these interchanges. Before, in the examples that I gave you, we had a linear superposition of the data that were available, aggregation. Now, by allowing those interactions between people, amazing things happen. Dig is a company where you can annotate news stories and you can express that you find something's interesting. And people interacting, that's the important element here. People interacting manage to create data in a very different way, in a positive feedback way, where you have in German Rückkopplungsschleifen, where things just move up very, very quickly, like microphones if the gain is too high. That was not possible pre roughly the last 10 years. So all these data, which were generated as byproducts of electronic exchanges and aggregated, now can interact with users and can be corrected by people. I'll return to the example that I gave you before, map data. If you ever tried to return a car at LaGuardia in New York, the airport, with a Hertz never lost or ever lost air navigation system, you realize they put you in an infinite loop. It's just a bug in the system. What way does the poor user have to express this? None. How pathetic is that? Why isn't there a button? Fix this. I got a piece of paper in the mail just before I left the States a couple of days ago saying, Verizon is proud to tell you that 10 million miles were traveled in the last half year by 4 employees. We are doing our very best to ensure that you have excellent phone service. Here it is, if you don't believe me. And we created 69 new cell sites so far this year to make sure that you feel taken care of. Bullshit. Don't they have data where the calls get dropped? Why do they need to have 10,000 mils driven by 4 people if they could just collect the data? Or better yet, and that's an example I have from John Bartel, better yet, why not put up Yahoo Maps or Google Maps and allow people to just put flags up there and saying, every time I turn from 280 into Sand Hill Road, my phone drops. Please fix this. Why don't we make things like that? And think about the marketing potential. If that site, then Verizon says, hey, you guys told us you want to have this fixed. Here's a cell tower. What a different way of user-generated data and of changing the world compared to sending out this flyer. Sources of data. Very briefly, in the olden days, it used to be that you had point of sales data, basically allowing you to know what you sold, but no idea about who the people were. Then you moved and had shopping basket analysis, knowing what got sold together. Beers and diapers is an example you all know from data mining. Then we moved on and said, hey, if we could only give people some way of having persistent ID, if we could give away some way of keeping sort of track of what that person buys, we can get closer to them. Okay. Then we moved on, and Amazon, for instance, on its first day, knowing about click data, it didn't only know what people actually bought, but it also knew what people didn't buy, but were considering buying. Google's 150, 200 billion market capitalization is based on intention data. Let's move further. What comes after intention? Attention. Attention data sources are a company in Portland, Oregon called Atensa, A-T-T-E-N-S-A. Atensa.com says, we are measuring your attention gestures. We're measuring that you forward something to someone, that you save something, that you annotate something, and so on and so forth. What are these measures of attention that allow us to actually come up with richer metadata about articles? The beautiful example Tom Coates gave yesterday about Flickr is another example of having really great metadata about data objects. Relationship data. Phone companies. I mentioned as an example yesterday that if you market to nearest neighbors, you have a factor of 4 improvement in terms of selling a product compared to the best machine learning models that ignore relational data. And I already mentioned for location data, Dash as an example, which changes the game by having an uplink to data. Mobile phones, by the way, could be the same thing here. You all know Google, and from the cradle to the grave, huge ways of collecting data, not only search, Google Checkout, which has been around for 1 year and 2 months now, Google Analytics, very smart, placing it in your website. So even if the user doesn't really care for having his data collected by Google, since Google gives value back to you, it's a great way for them to understand what's going on. Tuba, of course, and Google Mail, the OpenID stories from last week, all goes in the same direction, that it is a huge data factory. And small side remark here, when I talk to people at Facebook, so who actually should own identity? I was really surprised what answer they gave. What do you think? The main data guy at Facebook. The user? Not the user. He did not say Google should own it either. He said, ultimately, it's probably the government. The people who issue also passports should be the one who own identity. Just a thought to put in your minds. We talked about examples of shopping before when I went through the data sources there. People data, I mentioned white pages. A couple of other examples here are ZoomInfo. ZoomInfo is spidering the web and allowing you to correct the data. Very different approach from the approach LinkedIn or Ching has, where you have to fill in all the information. And there is a feature I would love to have, which allows me to, if you like, for a premium, to actually say, what changes did people make on their sites? That guy who was an SDE1, is a junior developer at a startup, over time he became the VP of engineering. The startup is long dead, of course. That's interesting information. So finally, what's the main point here? That we moved from shrink-wrapped data, like shrink-wrapped software which we ship, to constantly interacting with the data, cleaning them. David Holtzman, the former CTO of Network Solutions, has a very interesting theory that in a few years down the road, we don't have to worry about dirty data anymore. Because there will be just so many ways of us to access data that basically our data will be clean. Another interesting theory for me to put in your minds. How do people pay for data? There are two ways. One is you pay for data with money. The examples I gave you before, the old world, Axiom, etc. The other one is pay for data by giving data, by cleaning data, by paying for data with attention. Now, I see that Jonathan is getting nervous here, and I promised him to get 10 minutes, which should be, I think, right now. I will afterwards talk about trust, but as a small interlude, are you ready? As a small interlude, let's have 10 minutes of Jonathan on his perspective on the data business.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Why didn't you start that? Keep it up.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Jonathan Leventhal. I'm the Technology Director of Imagination. For those of you